Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is out today, but he'll be back tomorrow. Well, we have a lot to talk about this hour, but we're going to start with a tragic event that took place earlier today in Afghanistan. The United States Embassy in Kabul says an Afghan police officer working at a local hospital in the capital shot dead three American doctors. The hospital is run by CURE. That's a small U.S. Christian charity based in Lemoyne, Pennsylvania. I've been speaking with the BBC's Bilal Sawari, who joined us from Kabul.
According to the Interior Ministry, the attacker has been identified as Ainullah from the eastern city of Jalalabad, who was a member of the Afghan Public Protection Force. He opened fire on a group of 5 to 6 foreigners entering the hospital in West Kabul this morning, killing three American nationals. We are being told by the Health Ministry that all three were doctors. The Interior Ministry have said they were medical staff. And the attacker himself then tried to turn the gun on himself, but failed to kill himself, and he's being treated in the same facility. The Afghan Interior Ministry at this stage is going through his file, trying to interview members of his family and relatives and people who vouch for him, two tribal elders or two villagers and two government employees.
You talked about people vouching for this security guard, and indeed there is a great deal of that kind of background checking before an armed person is allowed to be in the company of foreigners, because so many shootings of this kind have taken place in the past.
Well, we have to wait for the Interior Ministry to see if there were any links to the Taliban, if he was a Taliban infiltrator, if he was a rogue soldier, if he was in the right mental state, if he was fit for this job. But what this attack has done, it has created a climate of fear among foreign aid workers, especially health workers. And the Ministry of Health here has said it was a big blow. People like these doctors or the oxygen of the health service, these people were treating tens of Afghans from Kabul, from districts around Kabul, from the provinces, providing the medical care that an Afghan could simply not get. These were expert doctors providing quality health care, as well as training their local Afghan colleagues. So as a result of this attack, this will definitely change the environment for foreign aid workers who work in Kabul, who rely on a credible environment so they can be able to go and work. And in this case, here was someone who was supposed to be protecting them who turned his gun and killed them.
Bilal Sawari is with the BBC and joins us from Kabul. Bilal, I had also understood that two of the American victims were father and son.
The health minister of Afghanistan, Dr. Soraya Dalil, also confirmed that to me, that they were visiting the doctor who had been working in this hospital for the last 7 years. We understand that the father and son were also working in the country, in the medical field. But at this stage, it's quite complicated to get all the details. I was able to talk to one Afghan doctor there who was in tears and said, look, someone so close, someone so committed to Afghanistan has been killed. And that entire medical family there is mourning. There are also patients who had known the doctor who had been serving there for the last 7, 8 years. So this is a shock, and this is a tragedy that's been felt by many people here. But more importantly, Afghanistan relies on foreign aid workers, on experts. This is a country where it does not have many trained doctors because of the war, because of the conflict. So this is seen as a big blow. In the last year or so, we've seen a number of attacks targeting foreigners and Westerners. So this is a worrying trend for many.
Three American doctors, aid workers shot dead in Afghanistan, apparently by their security guard, the BBC's Bilal Sawari from Kabul. Bilal, thank you.
Thank you.
Before we introduce my next two guests, take a listen first to Derek.
Hey, my name's Derek. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I get 10 to 15 headaches a month. About 3 months ago, my doctor found a daily medication that actually helps. When I get a terrible headache, I have to sit in the dark and the quiet and wait for it to pass. Sometimes my stomach even churns. It hurts so bad.
Derek is one of about 36 million Americans who suffer from migraines. Women suffer in particular. Here's one of the many contributions we've had. This is from Corvallis in Oregon. My mother has struggled from debilitating migraines since I can remember. We used to have to call an ambulance to pick her up and bring her to the ER. From a young age, I had to learn how to take care of her and the family when she was bedridden for days at a time. Now, over the last 50 years, there hasn't been a single drug developed that can prevent or certainly not cure migraines. But there's some new research in early stages that shows some hope that a prevention drug could be within reach. Two studies presented to the American Academy of Neurology examined two drugs that work by blocking a protein that ultimately stops the migraine from starting in some cases. Dr. David Dodick is the co-author of this research. He's also a professor of neurology at the Mayo Clinic and chairman of the American Migraine Foundation. Doctor, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. We also have Annalise Tobin. She's an analyst with Decision Resources, a healthcare information company, and she focuses on the migraine pharmaceutical market. Hi, Annalise.
Hi.
Dr. Dodick, let me start with you. I've had a couple of migraines, certainly not chronically, but people who hear this will know if they've ever had them. You can lose your vision. There's some blindness involved, debilitating headache, even nausea, dizziness. It's really terrible. People would really love to have some relief. Can you explain sort of how these drugs might work?
Well, we've known for about 20 years or so that there's a protein known as calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP for short, that appears to be very important in generating and maintaining a migraine attack. And so these drugs may work by preventing CGRP from exerting or doing what it does to generate an attack of migraine outside and even inside the brain.
So it blocks the protein that we see builds up like before a migraine comes around. Is that the idea?
That's the idea. So this protein actually will bind to receptors in nerves and in the throughout the brain. And so what this drug does is it binds to this protein and it prevents it from actually attaching itself to its receptor. And we believe that when that protein attaches itself to its receptor, it starts to generate a migraine attack.
Now, there's a great deal of excitement, Dr. Dodick, around your research. But one thing that I noticed, Dr. Dodick, is that you had an impressive 66% decrease in the frequency of migraines over a month in the 160 or so people in your study, but people who got placebo, sort of a dummy drug, had a 50% increase. So everybody kind of got better. It's just that your people got a slightly more better.
Well, you know, you've touched on something very important and something that we've struggled with in the migraine research space for quite some time. It's a problem with pain in general, but in migraine in particular, where placebo response rates are very high. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. In this particular study, we believe that not only was there a lot of anticipation and heightened expectation around getting a new and very novel drug that people thought was going to be effective, but also as the invasiveness of the treatment goes up or increases, so too does the placebo response. So when you inject a medication under the skin or intravenously, that is a much more powerful placebo effect than taking a pill, for example.
And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Dodick, you mentioned an IV injection under the skin. That's how these drugs work. Ultimately, to sort of have mass market appeal, what you really want is an easy-to-take pill. I mean, it's kind of a big deal to go in for an IV injection.
Well, that's true. I mean, but by the same token, most people don't like taking a pill every day. And when you're taking a drug that you're trying to prevent migraine attacks, you actually have to take it once or twice a day. So that a lot of patients are discouraged about taking medications every day. If you can get an intravenous infusion once every 3 months or once every 4 months, I think that would have a lot of appeal to people. Similarly, if you can take a medication once a month, subcutaneous injection like an insulin shot, for example, once a month, I think there would be a whole host of people who would rather do that than to swallow a pill every day, particularly if the side effect profile is minimal with these new medications.
All right. Well, let's find out. Let's turn to Annalise Tobin, who's an analyst with Decision Resources, an expert on the market for migraines. Annalise, what does the market look like? Are patients clamoring for a migraine drug that really, really works, even if it's an injection?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a substantial unmet need for better migraine prevention medications, both those that would be more efficacious and those that are more tolerable than what's currently on the market. And the issues that you raised about would patients want to go in for an injection, for an administration, rather than taking an oral pill, these were issues that were considered when Allergan was first getting regulatory approval for Botox for prevention of chronic migraines. And when before Botox was on the market for migraines, all the other medications were oral pills that you would take at home. There seems to be, now that Botox is approved for migraine, the uptake of Botox seems to be fairly good in the market, still in a small percentage of patients. But that is, I should say, a therapy that is injected sort of intramuscularly into the facial and the neck muscles once every 3 months by a trained physician. And patients are going in for that therapy. They're failing the oral therapies and looking for relief and going to Botox. And in some cases, patients are responding well to that therapy. So Allergan's Botox is basically sort of shown a path that there is an opportunity for physician-administered drugs in the migraine prevention space.
Well, Annalise Tobin, give us an idea, if you can, of how many billions in potential dollars we're talking about in this market if there's a successful preventative treatment for migraine.
That's a good question. It's hard to estimate. I'd say right now, we estimate that right now it's making around $200 to $300 million. Again, in a very small population of patients, but it's a relatively expensive therapy. And we think that over the next several years that will increase to at least $500 million.
So, Dr. Dodick, right now, people who want marginally effective treatment are getting injections in the face. You may have an alternative here, but what's left to do?
Well, what's left to do is to take these preliminary results and move into now large phase three studies, pivotal phase three studies that hopefully, if the efficacy and the safety and tolerability are confirmed in larger phase three studies, that may lead to regulatory approval by the FDA. So there's still work to be done to confirm these preliminary findings, and that generally means two large phase three trials.
Well, you heard it there. There is some promise in two small studies that there may be a treatment on the horizon to prevent migraines. Dr. David Dodick is co-author of that research, and he's professor of neurology at the Mayo Clinic. And we were also joined by Annalise Tobin, an analyst with Decision Resources. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Are you one of the 36 million Americans who suffers from migraines? We're always interested to hear your stories. We want to know how you cope. This comes to us from Somerville, New Jersey. I've had a migraine, which varies in intensity, but never really leaves. Almost every minute of every day for the last 5.5 years, it has cost me my ability to work and to support myself, the ability to do things I enjoy, and it has placed an enormous strain on my friendships as I'm unreliable where plans are concerned. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Well, still to come, we'll discover what stands in the way of a huge U.S.-Japan trade deal as President Obama continues his week-long trip through Asia. And we'll continue our discussion on the future of voting in America. We have a look at future technology that could make it easier to vote. But next, we'll talk about a new app that could make it harder for you to get your next job. Stay with us. Welcome back to the show. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry for one more day. Well, forget about those annoying job interview questions for a moment, like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? What if your next job interview instead sounded something like this?
Every time I miss, and they still jump up and down and are happy. Oh, there, plus 50 points. You win, it says. Now, I don't know. I feel skeptical. Maybe it's just being nice.
That is New Tech City host Manuja Marodi playing a video game called Balloon Brigade. She's in the studio with me now. This is a fun game. It's fast-paced, and depending on how you play, it might be the reason you get hired or, more importantly, don't get hired at your next job. Now, some companies are using video games like this as a way to evaluate potential employees. It lets them learn how candidates behave by monitoring their micro behaviors in games like this. Micro behaviors? Do they work well as a team? Are you patient enough? Are you quick? How do you function under pressure? Can you shoot down asteroids in the blink of an eye? No? Well, Manoush Zomorodi, as I said, managing editor and host of WNYC's New Tech City, joins me now in studio. Hi, Manoush.
Hi there. Great to be back.
I would love to avoid those annoying job interview questions, but being handed an iPhone and knowing that I'm being evaluated in my personality is unnerving.
Yeah, it is unnerving. And also, you can't game this, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? It's measuring things that you haven't even thought of. Like, how long did your finger hesitate over something? Were you strategic or were you more sort of cautious or hasty? It sort of measures all the different things about how you act that you can't. It's not just about whether you win the game or whether you're successful in this case with lobbing water balloons and killing the imps, which I was not that successful at, I have to say. And I spoke to the CEO of Knack. He's the guy who made this game, Balloon Brigade, and he has a bunch of other ones. And it's a new company that makes video games that are also being used as hiring tests. And he says each of these micro behaviors, they leave sort of digital breadcrumbs to create a profile of a person.
It's a stream. It's a very large data stream of your micro behaviors. And we collect all the digital breadcrumbs that you leave in the game as you play the game. And those breadcrumbs show us and tell us about how you think, how you problem solve, how you persist. Do you have the grit to deal with challenges? Because the game becomes very challenging and frenetic at some points.
So the key, though, is that they collect the data. I hate to use the term, right, big data, but this is what it's all about. So let's say, hypothetically, your responsiveness was off the charts good on one of these video games and you get a job working at a call center and you were awesome at the call center, right? Then HR would know to look for more people who played the game like you. So they need to follow this over time.
So this isn't necessarily about you didn't destroy enough balloons. It's more about establishing a pattern. Still, you know, it sounds so incredibly reductionist. You get along in the workplace because you like Jane and she likes you, but you don't like Billy and he's too domineering. I mean, hurling balloons at a tiger or whatever it may be just sounds like it's so cellular that it doesn't really say anything about me.
Well, you know, and we don't necessarily know. Like, it's very early days, I want to point out, with using games for hiring. And I spoke to The Atlantic's Don Peck. He's really an expert on hiring practices. And I asked him, you know, what proof do we have that these tests actually work? And he tells me this story about Hans Heringa. This is a guy at Royal Dutch Shell. His job is to find big experimental innovation projects. And it was taking him like 2 years to find the people who had the ideas that could really sort of see through. So he went to Knack, the guy you heard earlier, the CEO, and he said, here are 1,400 people. I'm going to get them to play the game. I'm going to tell you how they did for half of them. The other half, you tell me how they did. And he was absolutely floored. The game almost perfectly predicted who would be the successful innovators. Here's Don Peck.
Through gameplay alone, without ever meeting the scientists involved, without knowing their pedigree, without interviewing them, without even seeing their ideas, was actually very successful in predicting which scientists would have ideas that would ultimately pay off.
Now, whether those scientists got along or not, I don't know. But right. It turns out they had the key thing that they had was unbelievable discipline, and they're also open to new ways of thinking. And they learned this by playing a game called Wasabi Waiter, where players deliver digital sushi in a crowded restaurant.
Digital sushi. Does anybody have any idea, I have to ask, what would be the effective game app for the radio show host? You're talking and I'm listening, but I'm sitting here thinking, what could they force me to play that would tell them if I'm any good at this job?
Well, I mean, I played one game that told me that I had a low moral obligation for seeing tasks through. One of these game CEOs said to me, you know what? You don't know. Maybe having a low moral obligation, that actually means you're a good boss because you're good at giving orders and you don't feel badly about it. So it's hard to sort of quantify this. But I do want to point out what this could mean is that it doesn't mean where you went to school or who you know. These CEOs say that instead of a LinkedIn profile, maybe you would just have a number that symbolizes who you are.
a number that would link to your performance on a spreadsheet and how you compare with other people in terms of what was the term?
My low moral obligation. Low
moral.
That's what I have.
You have low moral obligation.
I have low moral obligation.
You sound like a terrible coworker.
Oh, don't I though? Yeah. Well, you'd have to ask the newsroom how I do on that. But you know, to me, I got annoyed because I thought, well, I've been told by Lean In and all these other women's books that I shouldn't spread myself too thin because I have kids and I work full time. And here, this test was measuring that as low moral obligation. You know, it's very, very, very early days with all of this. But I think on the one hand, it's not going to play to prejudice, what your gender is, what your sexual orientation is, where you went to school. The world is becoming more about how you perform and not sort of what the extra sort of signs that you have.
But do I want to see the day where this replaces sitting down with the boss? I mean, we all hate those questions. We hate job interviews. Maybe you'd like to be handed an iPad and say, go in the room and play the game for 45 minutes. Or maybe you feel like you have a winning personality and you don't want it to be distilled by Candy Crush.
Yeah, I think there are some people who would gladly take a video game, happily do this instead of having an inane conversation.
Well, we knew this day would come in a way. The generation that grew up playing Atari and then Nintendo and then PlayStation and then
right.
Xbox somehow is now using video games to decide who will and who won't get that next job. Manoj Zomorodi is managing editor and host of New Tech City, and she's been playing video games that, well, didn't
yeah,
keep you out
well.
Of this job, and we're glad for it.
Not yet.
Manoj, thank you.
Great to be here, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. The Wild West world of e-cigarettes is about to change. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is laying out sweeping new rules that for the first time extend its power from regular cigarettes to those electronic cigarettes. Now, to date, at least at the federal level, e-cigs have kind of slid under the regulatory radar, which kind of explains how they've been making so much money lately. But the new rules would ban the sale of e-cigarettes to anyone under 18 and require that people buying them show photo ID to prove their age, measures already mandated in a number of states, and that'll sound familiar. That's what they do with regular cigarettes. Michael Erickson is our go-to man on the topic. He's the founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the Office on Smoking and Health at the CDC. Michael, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
The FDA is supposed to have evidence that something is harmful, I guess, before they regulate it. What's the evidence that e-cigarettes are actually bad for you, or is there any?
Well, actually, foods and drugs and products like e-cigarettes need to be shown to be safe and effective. So e-cigarettes have been on the market without any regulation and without any knowledge as to whether they are harmful or not. They are clearly better than smoking because this is the smoke that contains the tars and the carcinogens. But whether they're safe or not is really unknown.
And probably will never be known. It's hard to imagine a company spending the money to find out that their product's not safe.
Well, that's why this regulation is so important, and this is, in many ways, a first step. The law that governs tobacco for the FDA never included e-cigarettes because, in actuality, e-cigarettes weren't even a factor. But the significance of today's action is the FDA is saying, we have authority over tobacco products, e-cigarettes are a tobacco product, and we intend to regulate them, starting with not selling cigarettes or e-cigarettes to minors.
Are they a tobacco product because the vaporized nicotine is extracted from the tobacco leaf?
A court of law determined that e-cigarettes are better classified as tobacco products for that reason as opposed to drug delivery devices. In reality, they're both. They deliver nicotine, which comes from tobacco, but they also are very sophisticated aerosol devices that provide vapor to the lungs very efficiently.
Isn't there a potential downside here, Michael? I mean, there's this old debate in public health about harm reduction. You can either try to keep something out of people's hands, hey, never smoke, never do these things, or you can say people are gonna smoke, let's try to make it a little less bad. And a lot of people think e-cigarettes are a lot less bad than tobacco. Why hem it in?
Well, that's the debate that's raging right now in the public health community, and I really do think there is a middle ground. And the middle ground is we do all that we can to get people from inhaling smoke. 70% of smokers want to quit, so even the customer base don't like the fact that they're inhaling smoke. And at the same time, responsibly market and regulate these nicotine delivery devices or e-cigarettes, keep them out of the hands of children, and don't make them so appealing that over the 50 million ex-smokers living in America today aren't attracted back to an addiction that they gave up and are very proud of having given up, and I'm one of those.
So if you gave your average public health school dean a couple of drinks and asked them honestly, would they say, keep these things out of the hands of kids so they don't get a taste for nicotine, but make sure they're available to adults so that they have an alternative to cigarettes?
I think that's pretty close. The real goal is to move smokers away from smoke, have them use nicotine, like in these cigarettes, as a bridge to hopefully, ultimately, quitting the addiction altogether. But if they don't, the e-cigarettes are likely a better alternative than traditional combusted cigarettes.
Well, the FDA is cracking down at least partially on e-cigarettes, but maybe they shouldn't go away entirely. That's Michael Erickson. He's founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University, former director of the Office on Smoking and Health at the CDC. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, you're listening there to the sound of a Japanese military band. They're playing at the state dinner for President Obama and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Now, President Obama reaffirmed the U.S.'s commitment to Japanese security earlier today in Japan, explicitly offering a security blanket should China move militarily against those disputed islands in the East China Sea. But at the same time, there's a huge trade deal hanging in the balance.
We have the opportunity by working together to help shape an open and innovative and dynamic economy throughout the Asia-Pacific region.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a gigantic regional pact covering everything from beef to wheat to farm equipment to toys, and it's central to the Obama administration's plans in Asia, those delayed plans. When the president moves on to South Korea tomorrow, the diplomacy is not going to get any easier. Seoul and Tokyo are on frosty terms. Their leaders are hardly speaking these days. For more on the diplomatic challenges ahead and on this big trade deal, we turn to David Pilling, Asia editor for the Financial Times and recent author of Bending Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival. Hi, David.
Hello, Todd.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, as I mentioned, is huge. It's gigantic. And the one thing that everyone in Japan and the other countries around the Asia-Pacific Rim and the United States seem to have in common is that nobody seems to like it very much, but they're pressing ahead anyway.
Well, they're sort of pressing ahead anyway. Today's talks ended rather abruptly, and Japan's trade minister said that they were over for the moment. I think until President Obama has fast track in the US, it's not very attractive for countries like Japan and the other countries in Asia to give up too much, because politically they will have to face down their own domestic opposition and vested interests. And if they do that and then a deal isn't struck, then they look kind of silly. So I think until Obama can convince people that there is a deal to be had, you're going to find countries like Japan being very cagey and very unwilling to give up too much.
Everybody's sort of holding their cards. Now, I should say that fast track is a piece of trade authority that the president wants. Other presidents have had it that lets them basically approve trade deals and only have Congress kind of chime in at the very end. They sort of don't get in on the debate. And these days, Congress isn't interested in that. Is it the gigantic size of this trade deal and all of the different markets that it touches that have so many different constituencies just uneasy about this thing?
I think it's not just the size. The deal is meant to be a 21st century deal, a high-level deal. But that involves not only reducing tariffs, which has been the business of big trade pacts in the past, but also things like protecting intellectual property, ensuring that countries tender fairly. There are all sorts of stipulations within this trade pact that would begin to seep into domestic legislation. So you have a very high aspiration, which of course means that many countries are nervous about what it might mean for them.
The president, of course, as I mentioned, tomorrow goes on to South Korea. What's at stake there? They're an extremely close trading partner. We've negotiated a free trade deal with them in the years past. What's at stake with the president and the South Koreans?
probably the main thing at the moment is actually the standoff between Japan and South Korea. From America's perspective, Japan and South Korea are its two strongest allies in Northeast Asia. But unfortunately, they don't talk to each other. The problem is that they disagree over history. And as a result, there's this frosty relation. But you have America wanting them to do things like share intelligence to move closer towards each other. But as I said, literally, you have the leaders of the countries not talking. So Obama's role, I think, is to try to knock their heads together, in a sense, so that its two closest allies can actually be singing from the same hymn sheet.
The same hymn sheet. And Reverend Obama has to try to get the South Koreans and the Japanese in the same pew, I suppose, to extend the metaphor. Frosty relations as the United States tries to assert its place in the 21st century in Asia. David Pilling, Financial Times Asia editor and author of Beyond Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival. David, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people. Created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, last February, Facebook shelled out, $19 billion for WhatsApp, and that instantly created 55 millionaires in Palo Alto at that tiny startup company. It was the purchase heard round the world, if you want, and even HBO took notice.
This guy's built a mediocre piece of software that might be worth something someday, and now they live here. Money flying all over Silicon Valley, but none of it ever seems to hit us.
That's the HBO series Silicon Valley, satirizing what's become a recurring story in Northern California of the tiny app that made it big. No, not big, huge. But that story has left some people in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street, the people who watch them, scratching their heads and wondering whether tech has re-entered the boom and bust era of the late 1990s. Over the last couple of days, two prominent hedge fund managers, David Einhorn and Jeff Ubin, have raised concerns about the future of Silicon Valley and even used that B word. That's right, bubble. Joining us is Josh Lerner, professor at Harvard Business School and author of The Architecture of Innovation. Hi, Josh.
Hi there.
Josh, I was reading in the Financial Times a little bit last night, and I read something interesting. I mentioned David Einhorn. Apparently, he's created a new group of stocks, startup stocks, if you will, that he calls the bubble basket, the ones that he believes are set to lose 90% of their value and thinks that maybe people should short them, bet on them to lose. What's going on?
Well, I think one thing we can say if we look at the history of venture and innovation is that it tends to go in booms and busts. And it's not just simply Silicon Valley, but if we were to go back to the invention of electricity or the canals in England, you'd see this sort of every major innovation seems to unleash a speculative frenzy, which leads to a lot of craziness in terms of outrageous valuations, high acquisition prices, public market overenthusiasm, and so forth. And I think this is probably no exception to that rule.
Part of the problem is that a lot of the companies that are doing the buying are absolutely swimming in cash. I mentioned Facebook at the top, Google. I mean, pardon me, but they have more money than they know what to do with, and that makes risk cheap.
Absolutely. And certainly we can think back to the 1990s where we saw companies with overvalued stock, at least with the benefit of hindsight, went and did a lot of very foolish things with those funds.
So what's Wall Street doing these days? I mentioned Einhorn and his bubble basket, which seems to try to be put a little bit of fear in other investors. There are people called activist hedge fund managers. Who are they and what's their role here?
Well, certainly when we think about the way that markets work, there's a lot of people telling us to buy, right? There's investment bankers who underwrite stocks. There are analysts who write analyses who tend to be rather positive in terms of their orientations. There aren't a lot of voices on the other side saying sell. And certainly one of the valuable roles that hedge funds can play is providing a voice of reason, another voice which says not everything is wonderful and let's view some of these situations with skepticism.
So the hedge funds that I always thought were kind of the go-go cash makers, the high flyers, are actually the ones stepping on the brakes here.
Well, certainly you see hedge funds with a whole bunch of different strategies, but certainly we've seen a lot of success in the last couple of years from people who have been the skeptics who have been willing to raise questions about companies and transactions.
So where is the value here? A lot of these startups are overvalued. I read that many of the companies, including Facebook, that had IPOs this year are now trading below their IPO price, which indicates inflated prices. But where do you see – where do people, I should say, where does the market see the actual value? I mean, I love WhatsApp. I use it all the time. Facebook bought it, and I went, oh, yeah, people love that thing.
Exactly. Well, I think that's – what you're getting at is a really important point, which is that just because there is a period of overheating or speculative frenzy or bubble, whatever word you want to use, it doesn't mean that the underlying technology is something that's worthless or unimportant. And in point of fact, when you go back and look at the frenzy that surrounded the introduction of electricity, there was a lot of overvaluation of companies. There was a lot of shady companies being set up by shady people, which ended up squandering a lot of money. But that doesn't mean that electricity wasn't a revolutionary technology. And I think in the same way, if we look at the kind of technologies that are being developed today to exploit the internet in all these kinds of social interfaces, it's hard not to feel that, you know, whatever the sort of craziness in the market, the inherent promise of these technologies to change our lives in very important ways is very much there at the same time.
At the same time, Josh Lerner, you know, a lot of people seem less concerned about this potential bubble than the tech bubble of 15 years ago. You know, pets.com, remember them? They don't exist anymore. There were a whole bunch of other internet businesses. It was all the rage. And when that bubble burst, it really rippled throughout the economy. This one, not as worrisome in that way? Why is it different?
Well, I think there's a couple things which make this one different. Certainly one of them is that it's been laser focused. In other words, when you think about what happened in 1999 and 2000, you had just simply thousands and thousands of companies getting venture capital for the first time and then basically being able to go public at outrageous valuations. And when he had a very large base of retail investors who were holding shares in those publicly traded stocks. Remember, you had people dropping out of business schools to start companies. You had people dropping out of work to day trade internet stocks,
sure,
and so forth. It was very broad in terms of its spread. Here, it's much more targeted. It's essentially not everybody and their brother with a winning company. It tends to be a relatively small number of winners who are either being acquired or else in a smaller set of cases going public. It's much more narrow and laser-like in terms of its focus this time around. And as a result, if a bubble deflates, it's likely to not have as broad economic-wide impact.
So maybe mom and pop in Michigan will be okay if this bubble bursts, but maybe a couple fewer Porsches and Range Rovers and dream mansions in Palo Alto.
Absolutely. And you can think about that as sort of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you know, you're right. If you're a luxury home builder in San Francisco, there may be a little less demand, but it also might ease some of the pressures that we're seeing in that city as well.
There's nothing more American than a boom, whether it's oil or electricity or tech. And there's nothing more American than a bust. Josh Lerner, professor at Harvard Business School and author of The Architecture of Innovation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we go back to a conversation that we started yesterday about voting. Should it be easier to cast that ballot?
This is Matt in Portland, Oregon, where all ballots are mailed in and have been for several years. And I think that should be an option for all voters. Why not make it easier to vote?
But one of you in St. Augustine, Florida, is not so convinced. I think it's pretty easy to vote now. It's more difficult to get on an airplane than it is to cast a ballot. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, and you can always reach out to us. There's much more at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Let's continue our conversation that we started yesterday when California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell discussed his bill that would give Congress the power to connect remotely, casting some votes or even attending committee hearings via computer. And when it comes to voting in America, many of you agree that the system should be made more accessible. From Irving, Texas, we heard this. I live in Texas. Voting is especially difficult for minorities, low and moderate income people, and women. Voting is a right, not a privilege for the wealthy few. Well, Congressman Swalwell's argument for Congress is a simple one. Technology can and should simplify the process in this country. It's a scary thought for some of you.
John Evans, I'm calling from Tacoma, Washington. After the well-documented scandal during the George Bush-Al Gore presidential race, it's really hard to have faith in the voting system, at least the national one. With electronic voting, it's so easy to just have one vote cast and tally up in the other column.
Some distrust there from one listener, but others of you are on board. From Daytona Beach in Florida, voting on the internet using your social security number and making it where you can check how you voted to make sure your vote really counted. So what will the future of voting in America look like? Joining me now to weigh in is Ronald Rivest, professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. He's also on the faculty of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. Welcome, Professor.
Hello, Todd.
It's great to have you. You know, before we start this discussion, we kind of have to acknowledge that voting isn't getting easier in this country. In a lot of places, it's getting harder. Now, that's a political issue between the parties, but nobody's using apps and Skype to make voting easier. They're making it harder with voter ID laws and a bunch of other things.
That seems to be the case, unfortunately. Technology plays a role in some of this, but a lot of it is political.
So what does the latest technology have to offer? Is it as simple as an app that verifies your social security number and anybody with a smartphone can do it? What's on the horizon?
That's a wonderful vision, but I don't think we're anywhere near making that reasonably secure yet. It comes up all the time. People are familiar with their smartphones, and they'd love to be able to vote with their smartphones. I would too. But there's lots of reasons why we're just not ready for that yet. And I think sticking to a paper ballot system at your local school or something like that is likely to be the preferred voting system for quite a while yet.
And it's even the case when people show up in person at the polling station, whether it's the local firehouse or the elementary school, even voting on an ATM-style console in person has been problematic for a lot of people.
It has been. I think one of the things that's not appreciated by a lot of people when they think about what a voting system is supposed to do, you should be able to go there, it should be easy to use, and of course the answer should be right. But one of the things that's sort of behind the scenes that's very important for a voting system is the answer needs to be verifiably right. That is, you need to produce evidence that the answer is correct, even to convince the losers they lost fair and square. And so having an audit trail is so important for the functioning of democracy.
I'm sitting here thinking, of course, as you describe this, everybody's thinking about voting officials in Florida staring
Absolutely.
At punch cards with chads with magnifying glasses.
Yeah, that was a sad moment in American voting. But on the other hand, at least they had an evidence trail to look at. Suppose you had that same situation. All they could say was, well, the computer said so-and-so won. And they say, let's have a recount. And they push the button and says, yep, he won. You know, that's totally unsatisfactory.
So with all of the things wrong with the potential for electronic or remote or technology-driven voting, what potential solutions are there? What's in development that people might come to accept one day?
There's a lot of technologists who are looking at this question closely, and I think we can make small steps towards better voting systems, but they need to be small steps. If you take a big step, you might be stepping off the cliff.
And what does that mean? I mean, I'm thinking that when I vote, last time I voted on a console, but it spat out a receipt that had my vote on a piece of paper that I brought home.
I don't know where you voted. The receipt should not have in plain text who you voted for, because that would enable vote selling. So one of the requirements for a good voting system is it should not enable vote selling. If you can take home a receipt that says I voted for so-and-so, you can take that down to your local bar and ask for your $20 for your vote or something.
Right? Maybe I should have. All right. It might not have had the candidate, but I did get an I voted slip or something, at least verify
right,
that I've
right.
been
so
there.
There's a fine line you want to go between giving the voter something that can allow them to prove who they voted for and is therefore sellable versus allowing them to verify that their vote was properly cast and counted the way they intended.
And how does the verification work in those cases?
So the key idea is after you cast your vote, you get a receipt that's basically a mathematical transformation of your vote. So you can't show it to somebody and prove to them how they voted, but you can then go online and look up and see that your vote is correctly recorded. And so there's a website that allows you to say, you know, my vote, my ballot number was such and such. Here's what my receipt says. And beyond that, there's additional verification that allows you to check that the tally is correct, that the sum of all these mathematically transformed votes gives you the right answer. But all in all, you get a path all the way from what's in your head to the final tally, and you know your vote counted as intended.
And it would also enable election officials in the event of a recount to go up, to be able to go back and verify.
Absolutely. Not just election officials. Anybody can go back and verify. You can look at the collection of votes on the website and say, is this the correct tally for that collection of votes? Even though you can't see how individuals voted, you can see that the overall tally is right.
So when you take a step back from this, Ronald Rivest, you know, the psychology of voting is very deeply held by a lot of people, certainly by campaigns who don't want to give up a certain vote to potential fraud from the other side. We're in this moment where in our heads we want voting to be easier because smartphones and ATMs make things so much easier. But we're also at a moment where voting is getting harder. Simple things like weekend voting, early voting, absentee voting are getting harder in so many other jurisdictions, and that's politics. So there are two major opposing forces here. I don't quite see where they can be reconciled.
Yeah, I think that there's no magic bullet here. Voting is always a question of trade-offs, and it's always an arena for pushing and shoving in the political arena as well. So you've got to trade off, you know, voter privacy versus security. You've got to trade off, you know, the demands of various political parties and so on too. I think there's a lot we could do on the political realm to make things easier. I'd be in favor of, you know, everything from nonpartisan administration to weekend voting and having a vacation day for voting. There's a lot we could do in that realm.
Do you think in the immediate term the answer to more participation might be making traditional voting easier and save the technological solutions for another day?
I think it may very well be. It's hard to tell. The studies that have come out seem to indicate that technology changes don't affect voter turnout much. I think that some of these other things that you're talking about, making the day easier, making provisional voting work very smoothly and so on, I think are much better help.
Hey, you know, in Australia, voting is compulsory. Now, the fine is only $40 if you don't go, but you got to go.
You got to go, but you could cast a blank ballot. That's allowed.
Right. You just got to show up.
You have to show up.
Should we have that here?
It hasn't been debated much here. I don't have a firm opinion about that. I think I can go either way. I think it might be helpful. Who knows? Give it a try.
Ronald Rivest has the chance to cast his vote, and he could go either way. But we appreciate him coming here to talk about the future of voting technology. It's dicey because whether or not you vote itself is extremely political. Ronald Rivest is with the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. He's also professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you.
Well, how would you feel about e-voting? And if you're nervous about digital, how about good old-fashioned snail mail? From South Carolina, we get this. All elections should be vote by mail. Your ballot arrives at your house. You never have to take off work to vote. And you can spend weeks reading about the issues and candidates before you decide to vote. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thanks for listening. John Hockenberry's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.